supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. You know, we're used to thinking about justice in terms of punishment and really retribution, but restorative justice practices aim instead at healing. Of course, the simplest form of restoring is a straightforward and meaningful apology, so that if I hurt you, then you have a choice. You can either cut off the relationship and walk away, and then I won't be able to hurt you anymore. And at one level, that makes sense. On the other hand, if we sit together and you tell me what my behavior has done to you, how I've hurt you, what it means to you, and then I can understand, and then I can apologize at a deeper level and try very hard never to do that again. You feel more restored, and so is our relationship. Look, Nelson Mandela brought this out beautifully with his truth and reconciliation hearings in South Africa. But nowhere is this practice more effective and more important than in schools at all age levels. Restorative practices help create a safer environment where they feel like they have a voice that is heard and respected. To help us understand more about these restorative practices in schools, we're joined by Betseda Ortiz. She's the assistant principal of the Warren Harding Middle School here in Philadelphia, and she's working to make the school a restorative practice environment. She joins us here in the studio. Betseda, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you.
It's nice to have you. And joining us by phone is Ted Wachtel. He is president and founder of the International Institute of Restorative Studies. Ted, great to have you on.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
And our phone number here is 888-477-9499. We'd love to hear from you about restorative practices, especially if you've had experiences with them. Ted, let's start with you.
Okay.
We'll start with the concept of restorative justice, which is what I learned about first. Tell us what it is and how long it's been around.
Well, and some people would say restorative justice has been around forever because it's, you know, seen as an indigenous practice at a time when people didn't have jails and prisons to send people away to. They had to restore their community because they were all living there together. And so I remember this Bonnie George from Wet'suwet'en, I think I said that right, nation in British Columbia, talking about, for them, it's all about healing the community. So getting people together to deal with the issue and talk about it in a way that they can gain a shared understanding. And then they even have the offender's family hold a big feast for everybody in their community. So it's really old if you take it that way. In modern sense, probably in the 70s, some of the first examples were some Canadian probation officers who got their permission to bring their client or probationer together with victims to negotiate restitution, and found that actually people valued being able to talk to each other and, you know, reflect on what happened more than actually the need for for payment. It was valuable to them to have the encounter. So that's the earliest that I know of in the mid-70s in the modern sense.
I, you know, when someone is injured, they feel disempowered in this. What's their role in this process?
Well, I think a victim, you know, there are people who study victimology and actually would suggest a list of items that people have a need to get questions answered. They want to know more about the circumstances of what happened. If something happened to someone loved, they want to know the details of it, you know, if God forbid they were killed. And so they have a need to get questions answered. They also have a need to be heard, to be acknowledged. And these processes actually do that for victims. So their role is to get what they need. and to be straightforward and, you know, bring up any issues and challenge people as to what happened and what were the circumstances. That's how they get what they want. And offenders are asked to cooperate. And, you know, it's a voluntary process, so victims choose to be involved. And for some people, it's really important for them to have a chance to do a face-to-face conversation with the offender. And it really helps them cope with the trauma that they often experience. It said, there's been some good research, a woman at University of Pennsylvania did a study a few years back and says, it's a one-shot deal that actually produces dramatic reductions in post-traumatic stress syndrome. So it's very important for victims, and their role is hopefully to get some understanding and relief.
It seems that restorative justice is about dealing with relationships that
absolutely
that are damaged. I get that in families and in friendships, but what about when a teenager assaults another or a stranger or even commits murder? Where's the relationship there?
Well, obviously, some people don't know each other, so you're not restoring the relationship. But in the larger sense, as per this Bonnie George, you're restoring the community. You're bringing some peace and healing to it, even if it isn't literally restoring a relationship that existed before. But what's really interesting, in my experience with restorative conferences, is actually you create relationships where they didn't even exist before. So there's a famous film called Facing the Demons, which shows a murder in Australia. And you see the folks, even some who chose not to participate because it was being videotaped, but the parents of the offender and children to this day still call each other occasionally. They actually got a relationship that sprung up out of a tragedy.
Yeah, we did a show about that. I think Yeah, the book was called Picking Cotton, and it was an amazing memoir of a woman who was raped and sent the wrong man, picked the wrong man out of a line and sent him to prison. And, you know, many years later, they had DNA testing, and it was the wrong guy. The right guy had already been in prison. But he forgave her, and the two of them now go around and lecture all over the country. So, you know, and I think about, you know, I was traumatized as a kid, abused, and my abuser is no longer living.
Right.
But there's a relationship there. I am in relationship with that
That's
man
right.
for the rest of my life.
And if you have an opportunity to make it a more positive relationship than the one you were left with, you know, that's nice if you can do it. And it's not always possible, and people aren't always amenable to offering that, but we see an awful lot of offenders who would like to, in that sense, make things right. And not that they need to have a personal relationship, but it changes the very negative, fearful. People see their people as demons. There's a great story in Australia about these little girls who were, the mother said they were going to need a psychologist because they were wetting their bed, wouldn't go out on the porch in dark after just a simple little motorbike was stolen from their porch. And after an opportunity to undemonize the kids that did it, their comment was, oh, they're just like the boys down the road. But they needed that opportunity to normalize that person who haunted them after the crime in their dreams. They actually found out, oh, just kids down the road, and it changed it, and it reduced the trauma for them of what was a relatively little incident for most people. But for little girls who somebody came to their house at night, it was really upsetting. And they get to resolve it.
See the humanity in other. And that's empowering.
It is.
That's empowering. Let's go to the phones. We've got Larry on the line. Hi, Larry.
Yes, hello. It's a wonderful show, wonderful idea. I was head of a conflict or a mediation group at a local church in Doylestown, an interfaith church. Mm-hmm. And we got interested in restorative justice and found that it was a much more humane way of dealing with breaking rules or transgressions than retributive justice is, and eventually wound up using that as one of our primary means. But it seems to me that such a good idea isn't getting around very well. I was hoping that in the 10 years since I've been doing that there, and we actually codified it in our rules and regs for the church, I was hoping that we'd be using them at least through all the Bucks County schools. And it hasn't happened. It's been very slow to go, and I wonder what can be done to speed up the appreciation for that.
It's almost like global warming. Let's hear what you have to say, Ted. And well, thanks
really
for your call.
On the reason for our existence. We are, among other things, a graduate school, professional development, advocacy. We make films. We make videos and, books we produce because we are about educating people to restorative practices. And you're right. It is a very slow change process, but I'm happy to say there has been a lot of change. And I want to mention the flip side just real quickly to restorative justices. I don't know if flip side's the right term. Restorative practices is a more inclusive term. So restorative practices includes restorative justice, which is a response to wrongdoing, but it also opens up the process to the proactive. So in schools, we don't want to sit and wait around until there are incidents so that you can then process and get everybody to, you know, build relationships or repair. What you want to do is start this year with lots of opportunities for kids to talk to each other. We use circles. There's a lot of other similar strategies, but it gives an opportunity for relationship building. And we've gone into 10 schools, including, well, you have the representative from Harding, so I'll shut up and let her talk about it. But we go in proactively with people to actually begin using circles and building relationships that then makes it easier to repair things when something does happen.
So,
and I'll shut up and let her talk.
Absolutely.
You should have seen her reaction when you backed away from restorative justice and talked about restorative practices. Oh, my God, her head was bobbing. And so talk to us, but say.
So I want to jump in and thank you, Ted. You did an amazing job, and I've learned so much from Ted and Mary Jo, and it's definitely a learning process. So at our school, at Warren G. Harding Middle School, we've just completed our second year in restorative practices, and the way I like to explain it is it's just the way that we do things. We don't want to be reactive. We want to begin with the beginning of every school year in building positive relationships with our students and teachers so that when there is a wrongdoing or a student, let's say, breaks the code of student conduct, that then the relationship is already there and we can talk about the problem and find solutions and alternatives.
How is that different from other schools? Don't all schools want to create positive relationships? Do you do something differently?
We absolutely do. Like I said, there's a process to restorative practice, and while it's about building relationships, you kind of have to instill that and infuse it within the community. So it's another way of building positive relationships. We have a lot of wonderful schools out there, and I'm sure that they have other ways of building relationships, but at Harding, we've seen that this is the way to do it. So we start every school year, or at least since we've started this in our second year, we kind of build time in the roster and expect and encourage teachers to hold circles at least once or twice a week.
I keep hearing circles.
So one of the aspects of restorative practice is having circles within the classroom, and this is what we encourage our teachers to do. And within the circle, initially, because it is about building relationships, we have topics that we're going to talk about, not necessarily any particular problem.
All right, so I'm your student, and I come in first day of school, and I'm in a circle. What am I doing?
Not necessarily. So you are in my class of, let's say, 30 to 33 students. Okay. And I'm going to begin to explain to you what restorative practice is, how we're going to do things, and our classroom, how we're going to build community within my classroom. We're going to respect each other. We are going to listen to each other. And one of the ways that we are going to do this is via a circle, and my classroom is set up in a circle, and I will talk about
the whole classroom's in a circle.
Correct. Okay. And now it doesn't mean that it's always going to be in a circle. We may form a circle when the teacher deems it's necessary. There are teachers that I have in my building that their classroom is always in a circle, but then there are teachers that form the circle when the need arises. So we will have topics about just usual check-in. For example, after a weekend, a teacher might just check in with students. How was your weekend? And what did you do this weekend? Just in a circle. But then there are other issues that might be occurring in the school. For example, bullying or cyberbullying. Right. And then we're going to talk about that.
I want to hear how that works, because when I spoke with you on the phone, I had some concerns. So let's say there's been bullying in school, or whatever, racial taunting, or whatever. So how are we going to deal with that?
So initially, again, each situation is different, but I, as a teacher, would speak to the victim first and speak to the offender as well, bring them in together and kind of talk about the process and let the offender first hear how the victim feels. And then if the offender agrees as well as the victim, we will then bring it into a circle. If it calls for a class circle, now naturally, if the other students did not see or know about the bullying, then we don't need to involve all of, you know, the students. So it depends. If it happened in the classroom and everyone saw it and everyone heard about it, then yes, this is a classroom issue, and we're going to talk about this as a classroom. It's very important for the teacher or the person that's facilitating the circle to come prepared with questions.
You are a trainer, and for this to work, teachers have to buy in, I would imagine, parents and maybe beyond. So I want to talk about how that works. And I'm going to raise my question about what happens to the, what happens to the, what's the word, perpetrator? I don't like that word.
The bully, whatever.
Bully, thank you. So I want to bring up all these issues. We're going to take a short break. Now I want to bring up these issues, and I want to go to the phones. We are talking about restorative practices in schools. Maybe we can even talk about it in families. Restorative practices. We're talking on the phone with Ted Wachtel. He's president and founder of the International Institute of Restorative Studies. Betseda Ortiz is the assistant principal of the Warren Harding Middle School in Philadelphia, and she's been implementing restorative practices in her school for the last 2 years. We'd love to hear from you, your experience with these restorative practices, or whether you'd like to have it in your school. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, 888-477-9499. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
As a proud supporter of WHYY, for more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
2014 marks the 50th anniversary of Freedom Summer, in which hundreds of mostly white student volunteers from colleges across the country spent weeks registering African Americans to vote in Mississippi. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Stanley Nelson, the director of a new documentary about Freedom Summer, and Charles Cobb, who helped organize the event. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
We're back on Voices in the Family. We're talking about restorative practices in school instead of crime and punishment and what has been labeled a school-to-prison pipeline. We're implementing in many schools around the country and the world restorative practices which are aimed at A, preventing these through good, safe, open relationships in school, and B, dealing with them in an honest and straightforward way that can help restore relationships. Ted Wachtel is with us. He's on the phone. He's president of the International Institute of Restorative Practices. Betsaida Ortiz is the assistant principal of Warren Harding Middle School, and she's been using them for the last 2 years. And our number is 888-477-9499. But Sid, I want to come back to your discussion about circles. And I want to know what happens if the bully comes into the circle. What happens then? Because I'm very concerned about shame with everybody going around the circle and pointing fingers at him or her.
Well, I'm glad you pointed that out, Dan. We have to actually train our students and our teachers. So it's a process. It just can't happen overnight. And let's say in this situation where the bully, he or she has to accept the wrongdoing that he or she did. So that, again, is a process. So the teacher or the facilitator should have had a previous conversation or should know in detail what the situation and concern is. And, you know, there are questions that need to be, you know, answered. And with restorative practices, there is a script, and there are questions for specific scenarios. So, for example, questions such as, what happened? What were you thinking about at that time? What have you thought about since? So these questions gives the opportunity to bring to light what the issue was and how you have affected someone else.
Ted, I listened to this through the eyes of a clinician, and I wonder, I've heard the phrase bad choices these kids make, but I mean, we all know what some of these kids are bringing to school. I mean, malnourished physically, emotionally, spiritually. They've got, you know, children who live with constant stress. We know their judgment can be impaired. We know they've got significant learning disabilities. That's what cortisol does to the brain. So it's beyond a simple bad choice. Ted?
I'm not sure exactly. I mean, we don't frame it just simply as a bad choice. It's really an opportunity. Each restorative interaction, whether it be a circle or a simple exchange of questions between a teacher and a kid, it's all about an opportunity for people to gain a shared understanding of everyone's perception of what happened. So if in a circle someone agrees to be in it, both the offender and the victim would have to agree for the kind of exchange that was just described. And you have a high chance of success because people, in a sense, are fulfilling their wish. They're coming because they want it to work, and a very high percentage of these things work. If someone's really resistant, an offender saying, "I didn't do it," you wouldn't hold the circle. You would just re-victimize the victim. So, you know, in this short time, we don't have a chance to give all the nuances. But also, there's ways that you can handle these things without going to a circle, where you give people a chance to talk and hear each other. And you could do it sometimes with a small, you might call it an impromptu conference with just a couple of people. So there's lots of ways to introduce safe opportunities for people to talk to each other in a real way and gain a shared understanding. And that's what happens when you give people voice and you give them some opportunity to make choice. You couple it with responsibility and accountability, but you're actually respecting people. So when a young person does something wrong and they're asked these questions, that were just described. They get to talk about what happened. And even if they're still making excuses for themselves or whatever, they start to feel that people are actually listening to them, because usually they're just handed a punishment. And when you create those spaces for people to hear each other and understand each other, it actually helps. And the evidence is compelling. I mean, dramatic decreases in schools that are out of control. West Philly was a sort of famous story for us in Philadelphia a few years back, where we were able to help them with the staff using restorative practices to get off the persistently dangerous schools list.
I wanted to jump in, thanks for that, Ted, and say I don't want to give the impression that this means that there will be no suspensions or that there will be no expulsions, because there are some non-negotiables.
Right.
And restorative practice actually means that we're going to support you, but we're also going to hold you accountable. So it's high support with a high level of accountability. So, for example, if a kid brings a weapon to school, we're not just going to say, okay, we're going to have a circle about this. There are laws that we have to, you know, live by and abide by, and there are things that we must do because we are responsible to, or we have to, according to the Code of Student Conduct, there are things that must occur. The, you know, weapon has to be reported, the child has to be suspended, and or, you know, there is a disciplinary process. But what's different with restorative practice is that although all of those things still have to occur, in the past we never really dealt with why the child brought the gun to school.
So we
still hold either a family conference, a conference, or a small circle, or a larger circle, depending on the situation, to figure out and to understand, why did you do this? And do you understand why you can't do this?
Sandra Bloom, a public health psychiatrist at Drexel, and one of the world's leading authorities on trauma, has created a concept of trauma-informed spaces.
Right.
So when someone acts up or acts out, the question in your mind is always, what happened to you that triggered all of this behavior? And you don't always ask it. That's not always the right question. But that's what you carry with you. And Ted, it sounds like that's some of what goes on.
That's a critical part. We actually teach a course, a separate course, which teases out in particular the whole issue of adversity, grief, and trauma. We call it restorative responses to grief, trauma, and adversity. And one of the main themes, we use actually the work of a psychiatrist. Sadly, she's, I believe, suffering from cancer, may have even died, but Katie Weingarten, a book called Common Shock. And she talks about the concept of compassionate witnessing. She was at Harvard as a psychiatrist, and she talked about the whole phenomena of just being willing to listen to what people have to say about what happened to them, that need to recount the story to a sympathetic ear, and you don't have to solve their problems. That's not what they're asking. They just want to be heard, and people really have the need to be heard, and that's what restorative practices does. And that in and of itself, having people honor them, listen to what they're having to say, treat their problem like it's serious, often helps people reduce the, the trauma and the syndrome.
I want to clarify, because I was saying that we want to know the why. We don't really want to know the why. I know Ted was probably cringing there.
No, we
want to ask the question, what happened, and how other people felt
better,
as a result as to your action. We don't really want to know the why.
Of course. Oftentimes, why is a tough question.
Yes, that is a tough question.
You know, I don't even knew why they did an impulsive act. They don't actually know why, so it's useful to say what happened, and they can talk about it.
Yeah, I don't even ask it that much in my office.
Right, because when you ask a middle schooler why, it's going to go back and forth. He hit me, he hit her, and we're never going to solve the issue.
No,
what happened.
What I was talking about was holding that.
Yes.
That no matter what they did, you're working with, assuming you're working with a child that's been injured at some level, and you, well, you know, not just a bad kid.
I
want to go back to the teachers, because, you know, but Seda, when we talked last week, on the phone, you talked about, gave an example, a good example of a student who stands up in classroom and you're in the middle school and might say F you to the teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Now, historically, but say that teachers said,
suspend
okay,
them.
You're out. Mm-hmm. You're out of here. And mm-hmm. and it gives the teacher a sense of control because, I don't know, if I'm a teacher and a kid stands up and does that to me, if I don't do something quickly and aggressively, I'm going to feel like I'm losing control of the classroom. So you got to get me on board to change a practice
sure.
I've been engaged in for
sure.
for a lot of years. But Seda, how do you do it?
Well, I have to say that this has changed me as a person as well, because prior to being an administrator, I was a teacher. And I know back then it's like, you curse me out. Oh, no, we're not doing that. So I, while the message is still the same, we don't want that behavior to repeat itself.
Exactly.
It'll happen depending on the teacher is in ultimate control within the classroom. So what might happen is, for example, if a student cursed a teacher out, maybe that teacher will say, you know what, in front of the class, I don't like how you are making me feel at this time, and I can't talk to you about it right now because ultimately I'm human as well, and you have offended me, so I'm going to send you to a buddy teacher, and then we're going to come back and we're going to revisit this. So
another
that
classroom.
For example, each school is differently. So at Harding, we have buddy teachers. So that kid might just need a break. And the teacher might need a break from mm-hmm. the child as well. So I might call my buddy teacher and say, hey, can you hold Johnny until next period? I need to have a conversation with him, depending on the teacher's schedule
right.
or whatever. The teacher then has a conversation with the student. And prior to that, maybe the teacher within the classroom will say, guys, I know that you just witnessed what happened. We don't want that type of behavior in our classroom, and we're going to address that, but not right now, because I need to go on with my math lesson, and I need
right.
to go on with my reading lesson. But we're going to revisit this, and I want you to think about what Johnny said and how that has affected you as a student
right.
and how it affected me. So now little Johnny is in another classroom. The teacher continues with the lesson, and perhaps later that day or the next day, the teacher has had already a conversation with the student and
right.
then brings the student into the classroom using the restorative practice questions.
I want to challenge that, because Johnny acts out and says F you to the teacher. He gets sent out of the room, and little Danny Gottlieb in the back of the room is not thinking about math. He's thinking about Johnny and the teacher. So what happens? And I'm sure I'm not alone.
When you say Dan in the back room is thinking about...
Yeah, another student in the back of the room is... I'm thinking about what happened with Johnny. I'm not thinking about the lesson. I mean, you want to go back to the lesson as a teacher, and I don't. I want to talk about what happened.
And again, each situation is different. That's why we have to start, you know, with building the relationships and setting the parameters within the classroom and how we're going to do things, because our kids are very savvy. We don't want them to just do things just to interrupt instruction so that teaching doesn't go on. So we have to be really savvy about how we do it and the rules by which we set forth in the classroom.
Yeah. If I can interject. You know, the devil's in the details. There's a million and one ways you mm-hmm. can respond to any given situation. But the rule of thumb is, we're not just handing out punishments. We're going to create opportunities for that young person to get an idea of how they affected me as a teacher. And whether you do it at that given moment or whether you postpone it, obviously, is a judgment call based on, obviously, lots of factors. But I think the whole question of control, which I think was really important
mm-hmm.
that you mentioned, is I think teachers have, unfortunately, the illusion of control, because when you use punishment as your primary strategy, it does work, kind of, sort of. It works when you're looking. But how do you create an environment and a school climate in which kids are behaving because they want to, because they like the way it feels when the place is sane and orderly, and they've internalized the reasons for doing it? That's what you achieve with restorative practices that you can't achieve with punishment, because you begin to get people to take ownership. That discussion in what just happened, that discussion in how we could prevent this from happening again, and giving kids a real say, so voice and some choices makes him feel connected to the school. And the evidence, you know, it's not, I'm not speculating on this, that's what you see happen. And I think that that's what would happen in that classroom. You know, it's a routine occurrence for somebody to act out, and people get used to how it's being handled. And I think that, you know, in this case, she chose to postpone it, but it could have been handled another way.
We've got to take another short break. I love the phrase you used with regard to teacher, the illusion of control, because I say that to parents all
right.
the time,
right.
You know, the illusion of control. Of course, I say that to individuals, too. You know, it's an illusion. We're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about this concept of buy-in. Students, teachers, parents, and I wonder if even the larger community. We're talking with Betseda Ortiz. She's the assistant principal of the Warren Harding Middle School here in Philadelphia. She's been using restorative practices for 2 years. Ted Wachtel is president and founder of the International Institute of Restorative Studies. If you've got experience with restorative practices, if you're interested in them, give us a call, 888-477-9499. Love to hear from you if you're a teacher or a principal. Again, that's 888-477-9499. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Support for WHYY comes from the new Wells Fargo Propel World American Express card, designed to bring the world within reach for Wells Fargo customers. Details at a local Philadelphia area branch or wellsfargo.com/propel. Wells Fargo, the world is open. Keep exploring.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Meet James Ward. His family was homeless and he crowdfunded his way to college. Now he has advice for other homeless teens.
Stay strong and ambitious and determined, because there's 1,000 reasons why you shouldn't succeed in life, but all you need is one to get to where you need to be.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Amtrak, featuring patripsbytrain.com, offering train packages to destinations along Amtrak's Keystone service line. More information on available excursion packages at patripsbytrain.com.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, talking with Ted Wachtel and Betseda Ortiz about restorative practices in schools. So, Ted, we're talking about teacher buy-in, but I would imagine, you know, we've got to get buy-in from parents and maybe even beyond that to the community. Do we? Do we have you there? No. Go
so
on. Why don't you answer it?
I'm going to jump in. We are, this is definitely a work in progress, and there's a lot of work to be done. It's not something that restorative practices that our community is used to. And you are correct. There has to be teacher buy-in. Initially, when we first started our first year, we were able to train the entire staff all at one time. So while we were experiencing it, all of our teachers were participating in it. And then in our second year, we had a lot of new teachers join our staff because we inherited a lot of new students.
When I spoke to you earlier, you talked about a lot of transition.
Transient population,
yeah.
Correct. So with students shifting from schools to schools throughout the year for various, you know, personal reasons, it does become a challenge to consistently do this. So initially, if there is a teacher that may not understand the reasons to why and they have not gone through the training, I always ask, well, what did you do in the past and how has that worked for you? And if
that's
not
question.
Working, yeah. Then we need to give this a try, because it is about our students. It is about our kids. Ultimately, if I go into a classroom, they're going to respond positively to me and they're going to behave to me. But when you close that door, it is you with 33 students. So it is important that you do give this a try. and see how you're going to reap the benefits, because it's going to make your job easier. I often tell my teachers and people that are new to this, when someone respects you, they're not going to mistreat you. When you respect someone and you love someone, you're not going to curse them out. I'm talking about a teacher and kids in a classroom. You might have your bad moments or your bad days, but that's not something because you value this teacher, you respect them. And how do we get students to that point? By that relationship building, you know, on a consistent basis. So at Harding, for example, we built into our roster weekly school-wide circles so that it's done on a consistent basis.
What do you mean school-wide circles?
School-wide circles. So let's say each classroom will be holding a circle once a week at a minimum during various times of the day. So, for example, if I am a English teacher, I will have my circle second period every Tuesday. So now if I have 33 students and five had transferred out and I have two new incoming students, they are now being introduced to how we do things in my classroom. So it's a consistent, you know, process that we're going through.
Ted, I wonder if you can expand this a little further. I would imagine parents need to buy in, and I wonder even about the larger community.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, we started working directly with professionals in schools, but we've become involved in the whole concern of implementation. Once you learn how to do the training and share the skills, you go on to the questions of what you're touching on. How do you get teachers on a wider scale, get a higher percentage of buy-in? How do you get parents? How do you get kids? And we're actually trying some experiments with that. We plan to do through the summer and into the fall some Saturday and weekday events, training events that we're going to try to open up to parents parents and teachers. In fact, there'll be teachers who haven't got training when people shift around. So in August, there'll be an opportunity for those who want to come to a training that's not scheduled as part of their in-service days. But we're going to open up to the public, and we're also going to try to do some community organizing around restorative practices to get support for them, because if people know what they are, when the next administrator changes and brings in some new innovation and wants to put this aside, and yet it's achieved results, by having the community know what it is, by having the kids know what it is, I think it'll become politically very difficult to move away from something that's working. And that's been a big concern of ours. We've had some great successes and then had them drift away with a change in administration. So it has to get to the public. They need to understand it, and we're going to be trying some experiments. If people would like to in any way be involved, we have a website called restorativeworks.net, and it's a more public-oriented website. So restorativeworks.net, people could sign up for our e-forum and could even say they're interested in knowing about developments as they come about in Philadelphia.
I wonder about research. I'm hearing from both of you a lot of positive response.
Sure.
But I wonder about
sure.
follow-up. We had someone that was interested in follow-up,
sure,
and does it last? Do we have studies?
Sure.
Go, Ted.
Well, really, you know, you have to at some point have an empirical basis for what you're doing. We were having great anecdotes. We started with before and after data. We'd get schools to use whatever behavioral measures they used in their school, and, you know, tracking incidents and detentions and the like, and we'd compare before and after. So that's one type of study. It's not considered the most sophisticated study, although if you do it enough times, it begins to have credibility. But you begin to think, well, could there be other variables? So what are called randomized control studies are considered the highest form of science. We're now involved in two of them, one up in Maine, where the NIH has funded RAND Corporation to work with us in implementing in a number of schools, and in some of them we won't implement for a couple of years, so we can compare the outcomes on mental health measures where restorative practices have been introduced and where they have not. Similarly, we're working with Johns Hopkins on a study that involves randomizing in a program, I think it's called Diplomas Now. It's a large study, and this would be one area of study. So there is good research coming now beyond just the before and after data we had.
I'm interested in diversity here, but say that this middle school, Harding Middle School, is primarily black and Hispanic. And you've said 100% economically disadvantaged. So I wonder what the atmosphere there was like then and now, if there is a change, because you keep using the phrase a work in progress.
Yes, and I continue to say use the phrase a work in progress because every new year we're going to have new students, again, with a transient population. But not only that, we're going to have new sixth grade students coming in because our school is sixth, sure, seventh, and eighth grade, and we're going to have our current eighth graders exiting, you know, going into high school. And then we have the transient population with students coming in and out in the middle of the year, from different schools or different countries. So it is, when I say a work in progress, it's not just it's not a magic pill. It's not a one-shot deal. And it's something that we have to consistently, you know, do.
Ted, you talked about, you know, getting money from funding from NIH, so on and so forth. Let's say a school principal or a superintendent's listening to the show now and wants to implement it in one of the schools in this district. How much does it cost?
Well, it depends. There's a website called saferseniorschools.org, and people can reach us through that. It describes what we call our two-year whole school change program, which Harding is the only school in Philly that's in its second year now. The other schools we're working with are in their first year. But that's where you can, that page has a lot of detailed information, explains, you know, how we break everything down into the 11 essential elements. What would it look like if a school was restorative and how you can evaluate it? And we go into a lot of detail. So that would offer people the program, and the cost would range depending on, honestly, how much they want to add to improve the chances. We contract, we'll come and send consultants after the training, which is important, not just to show up for a few trainings, and it depends on how many people. But it can cost anywhere from $30,000 to $60,000, I'm guessing. I don't actually do the pricing, but it would depend on how heavy a dose of it you want over the 2 years. That's a factor, you know.
Wow. So, guessing, Bitsaida, this project is not coming out of the budget of the Warren Harding Middle School.
Well, as it relates to the budget, I would have to defer that more to, you know, my principal. But I do know I came to Harding 2 years ago. So when I got there, it was in the first year of its implementation. Like, it had not. So there was some training that had occurred, and it was already budgeted at that time, so I don't know the specifics.
I know a little bit about it. There was some money from Harding. They had some money the first year, but they became part of a much larger initiative. Philadelphia Foundation, in one of its biggest grants ever, awarded funds to our organization to implement in 10 schools, and also to Devereux Foundation, working with PBIS, another approach to behavior that's gained some reputation for efficacy, and that those two were implemented under this grant, in particular with what are called receiving schools, schools that were receiving kids from the schools that were closing. They felt that would help with the integration.
I'm curious about what this practice might look like in the Warren Harding Middle School, that's depressed inner city in Philadelphia, and versus what it might look like in a depressed Midwestern school district. Any difference, or does it look the same?
It looks the same. I mean, you know, people might look different given the demographics of an area, but people are people, and the issues in American high schools are fairly universal, I think, from place to place. So in many respects, it would look the same from the point of view of how you would introduce it and what the kind of problems you were facing. You may have differences in severity of the environmental factors, a place that's more severely affected economically, but it would still play out in the school and look pretty much the same.
So I think that the philosophy and the belief would be the same, but how you implement it in the various schools according to what you already have currently in the school would be different. So again, I think you have to have administrators that have that vision. Mm-hmm. And luckily, Michael Calderon, who is my principal, and myself, we have the same vision. This can be done, so we are able to implement our model, how it fits our building, our school, and our students.
And they've done an extraordinary job, without question.
Yeah, so give me the quick answer. How has the atmosphere changed in the hallways since you've been there?
So,
or has it?
I continue to say, and you pointed that out, Dan, work in progress. We inherited almost half of our student population last year with all the schools that were being closed down. We inherited a lot of students and a lot of new teachers into our building. So we had to retrain teachers. We had to retrain students. And it was a challenge. And it has been a challenge.
And will probably continue to be.
Correct. So we have to be a little bit smarter as to how quickly we're going to do it. And now we're a little bit more experienced. I mean, we're not the end-all be-all, but now we have a little experience, and we're, as a matter of fact, this week we have teachers that are being trained in our building to be trainers on restorative practices. We're already planning how we're going to start in September, how we're going to target the teachers that are not trained and the students that are not trained.
Spoken like a good teacher.
So there's local training capacity. That's critical.
So, unfortunately, we've got to end. Ted Wachtel, I want to thank you so much.
Thank you,
Ted. Not just for joining us, but for the work you do.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
And Betsaida, I want to say to you, before we went on the air, you said you were nervous. What I didn't tell you is this is the first time in years that I've spent an hour with an assistant principal without getting in trouble. So I was nervous too. So thank you, Betsaida, for the work you do.
You're welcome.
I wasn't joking. I was serious about that. Next week on Voices in the Family, we're going to take a fresh look at grief, how it works, how we experience it, and how we get through it. Well, to download our podcast, go to whyy.org/voices. At Twitter, we're in Voices in the Fam. And please reach me at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Lindsay Carfagno is our summer intern. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our production assistant and directed today's show. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Gita Simons is our producer. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb, or Little Danny in the back row. Have a great week, my friends.
You're listening to